Hello, and welcome to Civility and Solutions, a podcast brought to you by your Court Services section of the Supreme Court of Ohio. I am your host, longtime justice enthusiast, Kate Munger. This is a podcast about inspirational ideas for courts from across our 88 beautiful counties. The idea of a podcast was conceived as a way to be able to present content that was developed for the 2020 Dispute Resolution Conference. That conference was unfortunately called off for that plan-crushing pandemic called COVID-19. We are happy to be able to use this platform to share solutions and challenges with courts and any listeners who want to stay on the cutting edge of dispute resolution and court services issues. Today's topic relates to appellate mediation. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 4, our topic, appellate mediation. Joining me today in the new normal is Carrie Connolly, mediation attorney and assistant court administrator with the Ohio 6th District Court of Appeals, and Rick Dove, director of the Board of Professional Conduct at the Supreme Court of Ohio. Thank you both so much for being here.
You're welcome.
Carrie, I'm especially excited to have you on the podcast today because we were classmates at the University of Toledo College of Law.
Not too long ago.
No, so recently, very recently.
Yes.
Yeah. What did you like about going to UT for law school?
Well, it's very close to the Great Lakes. I love being near the water, near Lake Erie, and of course, has a very collegial legal environment. The Toledo Bar Association did a great job mentoring students. I had a lot of great practical experience while I was in law school. I worked for two different judges when I was there. And I think that helped me, find a job right after law school and stay in the area.
That's great. Yeah, me too. I had the same experience. And now you're a mediation attorney and assistant court administrator at Ohio's 6th District Court of Appeals. So as long as we have you here, let's get some insider information about appellate court. What's a common mistake that you see attorneys or parties making when filing an appeal?
Probably not reading our local rules. So as you know, the Ohio appellate court system is divided into 12 districts, and the lines are drawn according to population. So we have 8 different counties within our district, and sometimes we get attorneys who come from outside of the area, and sometimes the caption will not be correct. It might be captioned in the Court of Appeals instead of the trial court. And they might include a press fee and docketing statement that are for other districts and not our district. So I would just say, not focusing on our local rules and getting on our website and downloading the correct forms.
Gotcha. You've been, you were talking about the Bar Association assisting you in law school, and now you're the board vice president of the Toledo Women's Bar Association. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. And I've actually been on that board in some capacity since I graduated from law school. I think I was the law school liaison for a couple of years right after I graduated from law school, just because I think I was just one of the youngest people, and they probably thought that I would, still know some ins and outs of things that are happening at the law school. But since then, I have moved around. I've been the treasurer, secretary. So I was the vice president last year, and I'm the president-elect this year. So next year I will be the president if everything goes according to plan. We'll see what happens after that.
Well, give a plug for the Toledo Women's Bar Association. Why should women in Toledo join that?
it is a great way to resource. I think that practicing law as a female attorney has some different barriers and bonuses. So it's a way to connect with attorneys who are similar to you, who might experience the same hurdles or barriers that face many women, you know, especially when it comes to having children, you know, working to try to create the elusive work-life balance, you know, just to, and really just a way to connect with other women who are practicing in the area.
That's cool. I thought you were going to say more about like margarita happy hours, but all that sounds great too.
I'm not sure if anybody really has time for margarita happy hours, man. But if you do, there are opportunities for that as well. We have, you know, we commonly have networking opportunities with the Ohio State Bar Association, and there's usually wine involved with those. So there's an opportunity for that.
Oh, good.
Where do I sign up?
Rick, I'm going to send you a link. We would love to have you.
All right, I'll be there.
Turning to Rick, you've been at the Supreme Court of Ohio for quite some time. How long have you worked there?
Yeah, some say would say too long. I started with the court in 1989, so it's been 31 years, going on 32. I've been with the board for 9.5 of those years. Prior to that, I was on the court staff. And like Carrie, I like the Great Lakes, even though I didn't go to law school at Toledo. Spend a lot of time up there in the summer near Vermilion, Ohio. So,
where did you go to law school?
I went to Capitol.
Nice. Here in town.
No Great Lakes near Columbus.
We've got the Olentangy River, though. So
exactly. Yeah.
That's got to be kind of close. For those who don't know, can you tell a little bit about the Board of Professional Conduct? What's the makeup of the board? What's its purpose?
Sure. The board is a quasi-independent entity established by the Supreme Court by rule, and it is the second oldest committee that the Supreme Court has behind the Board of Bar Examiners. Our responsibility, when the board was created in 1957, the board responsibilities primarily are to adjudicate disciplinary matters involving lawyers and judges. So if there's a formal disciplinary complaint filed by disciplinary counsel or a certified grievance committee, our commissioners conduct a hearing, and 3-member panels, write a report and a recommendation considered by the full board. And then that board recommendation is filed with the Supreme Court of Ohio for the Supreme Court's review. We have 28 volunteer commissioners who are appointed by the justices to 3-year terms, and they are from appellate districts around the state. Commissioners are attorneys, judges, and then we have 4 non-attorney members of our 28-member board who represent the public on the board. And they have backgrounds ranging from legislative lobbyists to a retired dentist, businessman, just different kinds, all different kinds of backgrounds. We used to have a former undercover police officer who was on our board, who did drug buys when he was on the police force. He was an undercover agent in drug enforcement. So, very interesting group of individuals who devote a significant amount of time to the work of the board. And then, aside from the adjudication at the staff level, we engage in quite a bit of education and outreach activities to promote compliance with the rules of professional conduct and the code of judicial conduct.
So I think it's exceptionally important work to hold lawyers and judges to the high standards of ethics and conduct. Do you feel the weight of that responsibility in your role?
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, it's important because our primary, from the standpoint of enforcement, our primary responsibility is to protect the public. So we're looking to at lawyers who have engaged in misconduct and recommending sanctions to the Supreme Court that are intended to protect the public from further harm by that lawyer, but also to educate other lawyers about the consequences of running afoul of the rules. With respect to our education activities, pre-COVID, we would do probably about 40 continuing education seminars a year for a variety of audiences, judges, lawyers, magistrates, law students. So that meant we had somebody out on the road doing a CLE presentation or some type of presentation about once every 7 or 8 days. And then our staff handles about 2,000 telephone calls and emails from judges and lawyers and judicial candidates who have questions about their own compliance with the rules and are looking for guidance before, you know, they run afoul of those rules. So, again, those were all pre-COVID numbers, but that's a substantial portion of our education effort. And then, of course, our website's another tool to get information out about advisory opinions, ethics guides, which we'll talk about in a little while later, and other information for lawyers and judges who are looking for ethics information.
That's great. I listened to the most interesting talk about judges who are running for election and all the rules that they have. Mm-hmm. And I was just shocked by like how many things you have to consider when you're running for election for judge versus some other office. There's a lot of ethical considerations.
Absolutely are. I mean, and this is being recorded in the fall, so it's right, you know, about 6 weeks or so out from the election, and we're fielding several calls in the last few weeks from folks that are running for office, whether they're running for re-election or they're first-time candidates, about advertising issues. The questions have been a little bit different this year because of COVID and changes in the way in which candidates have campaigned. We used to get questions in the summer that we call our fair festivals and parades questions. We didn't get as many of those this year because there weren't fairs and festivals and parades, but getting questions about doing virtual fundraising events and using social media to communicate with voters.
Wow. So that's going to be like kind of a whole new world for your office to like delve into all those considerations too.
To some degree, yes. And especially for me, who's maybe not as tech savvy as someone younger, you know, it's been somewhat of an education for me about the different ways that candidates can communicate with electors, prospective voters, and get their message out other than the traditional means of mail and door-to-door and TV and radio advertisement, newspaper advertisements. They're using many different, new and different means of getting the word out to voters prior to the election.
Keep you on your toes. So you both were set to present on appellate mediation at the Dispute Resolution Conference this year. Are you both ready to try our new podcast format for your topic today?
Sure, why not?
I think so. Let's give it a try.
Okay, so to start, as Carrie was saying earlier, Ohio's appellate courts consist of 12 district courts. And some districts only have one county, such as the first district, which is just Hamilton County, where Cincinnati is, and other districts cover multiple counties, sometimes over wide geographic areas. So Carrie, where is the sixth district where you work located?
So the sixth district Court of Appeals runs along the border of Michigan and Northwest Ohio. Our westernmost county is Williams County. And it's the running joke that because we just have so few appeals from Williams County that we just joke that they go to Indiana if they have any problems. So Williams County is our westernmost county, and it is situated on the Indiana and Michigan border. Then we have Fulton County, Lucas County, Wood County is our southernmost county. So that would be Bowling Green, Perrysburg, and then Ottawa County, and then Huron and Erie counties. So, and as you know, Cedar Point is in Erie County. We also...
That's my favorite place on earth.
Yeah. So, and we also have Sandusky County. We see a lot of Cleveland attorneys just because they typically practice in Erie County, but we are situated right along Lake Erie, and we go all the way over to Indiana. And we have eight different counties in total. And Lucas County is our largest county, and that's where our building is located. So that's a little bit about the counties in the 6th District.
So I'm sure a lot of people listening to this podcast will be very familiar with the appellate system, but others may not be. Can you just give a little background about how the Ohio appellate system works?
Sure, I'll give it my best effort. So we have, in the state of Ohio, as you know, we have state trial courts, and those are municipal courts. We also have county courts, which are general jurisdiction courts, and we also have common pleas courts that handle felony type cases and civil cases involving a larger amount of money. We also have Board of Tax Appeals and domestic relations courts, juvenile courts, probate courts. So we hear appeals from all of those general jurisdiction courts. Once the trial court in those cases enters a decision, either whether it's a criminal conviction and sentence or a summary judgment order or a dismissal, the parties can then appeal to the Court of Appeals wherever that trial court is located. So if somebody has, you know, an OVI conviction from Toledo Municipal Court, they can then file the notice of appeal within, typically within 30 days. There are some exceptions to that, to the 6th District Court of Appeals, since Toledo Municipal Court is located within the 6th District's jurisdiction. You know, if something came out of Hamilton County Municipal Court, they would appeal that to the 1st District Court of Appeals. So the appellate courts have intermediate jurisdiction. And then if a party is not satisfied with our decision, once our court enters a decision, then they could always appeal that to the Supreme Court of Ohio, but the Supreme Court has discretionary jurisdiction, meaning that they don't necessarily have to accept the appeal from our court. So a lot of times our court really is the court of last resort, just because we have to hear all of the appeals as long as they are timely filed and within our jurisdiction. The Supreme Court does not necessarily have to accept those appeals.
That was an awesome overview. Thank you. That was perfect. Let's start first about talking about the status of appellate mediation in Ohio. How widespread is it?
Well, it is, I believe that 9 different districts now have appellate mediation. There are some districts that do not have mediation, but some of them have what they call pre-hearing conferences, where they might have, you know, a case before one of the judges to just, you know, see if there's any room for resolution, but it's not necessarily a mediation in the sense, you know, the parties come together and try to reach some sort of an agreement. But a lot, and it really varies between the districts. So, you know, the 8th District Court of Appeals has a full-time mediator. The 10th District Court of Appeals have 2 full-time mediators. And really, mediation is just part of my job. So all of the appellate districts handle it differently, and I think it really has to do with the volume of cases that they hear in their court.
Now, there's been a recent rule change about mediation, Rule of Superintendent 16. Carrie, can you tell us about that?
Sure. That would have been very recent, you know, had we had this conference back in March, but the rule just changed as of January 1st, 2020. And for the first time, that rule actually applies to appellate courts now. And some of the major changes are under Superintendent's Rule 1621. And it just states that any court using mediation, if you have a local rule that, if you have mediation, you must have a local rule that addresses your mediation program, and it must incorporate by reference Revised Code 2710, which is the Uniform Mediation Act. It must identify the types of cases that are eligible for mediation. So it has to say, you know, all civil cases, administrative cases, et cetera. It must address the confidentiality of mediations. So as you know, under the Uniform Mediation Act, communications are considered privileged. However, the parties can agree to keep those confidential. So your local rule must say, you know, whether or not the communications are going to be considered confidential. Our local rule does just say all the communications are going to be considered confidential, just so we don't have to spend time reaching an agreement as to the confidentiality. The rule must also address any prohibitions regarding domestic violence prosecution and adjudication. So you can't use mediation as an alternative to prosecute domestic violence. So your rule must address that. It must establish procedures for encouraging referrals for legal counsel or other support services for all parties, including victims and suspected victims of domestic violence. And it just must address any other provisions with respect to your program. So it's a big rule change, especially for the appellate courts. I know most appellate courts did have local rules that address their mediation programs. But for those that didn't, or if you had a local rule, it had you probably had to modify it to make sure it complied with the new superintendent's rule.
Right, and that applied to all the lower courts too that had mediation rules. Everybody who has any mediation programs at court has to change their local rule to make sure that they include all that. And I can tell you, I've looked at every single appellate district court, and all of the local rules for all the courts are on the web, on their websites. So if anybody wants to look at your specific district court to see what they say about mediation, I know it's up there. I know it's on the web. So they keep them pretty well updated there. Okay, so a lot of attorneys are great litigators or great writers, but they may be more unfamiliar with mediation. And I know as an attorney, if I'm not familiar with it, I don't want to touch it. So, Carrie, what advice do you have for attorneys who are trying to prepare for their first appellate mediation?
Well, the first piece of advice that I would have is to, you know, look at what are your options available for the appeal. So what type of case are you appealing? You know, what was the disposition of the trial court? Was it a summary judgment issue? Did it have something to do with, you know, an affidavit that was filed? Was it a dismissal, you know, with prejudice? You know, what exactly was the circumstances of your, of the disposition of the trial court? And what are your options then at the appellate level? And that is, you know, what is the standard of review going to be when our judges review it? How are they going to look at it? Is it an abuse of discretion? You know, what will our court be looking at? So that's the kind of the first thing to look at. You know, what was the disposition? What's the standard of review? You know, are there other options available to you? So if there was a final judgment, you of course have to file an appeal. But could you simultaneously file, you know, like a civil 60B motion if you think that it was just some sort of an error on the trial court's part? Or could we mediate that and say, you know, does everybody agree that this should be sent down to the trial, back down to the trial court to correct something that might have just been like a calculation error or something like that? You know, look at the type of case, look at decisions from our court that have addressed the same issue to maybe get a sense of how our court might handle that to see, you know, if they're, you know, if it's something that our court routinely affirms based upon the facts and the law. Is this something that maybe you would want to try to mediate instead of proceeding with the appeal? So really just look at all of your options available to you for the appeal. And then the next part is really, if you decide that mediation is an option for you, prepare your client for the mediation. And there are different ways to do that. And it just really depends on, you know, where, I guess, what the proceedings were like in the trial court. If it was a summary judgment type issue, a lot of times litigants just really want to feel that they are heard. Because if it was a summary judgment issue, they might not have had a chance to tell their story to anybody and have anybody listen. But if they've gone through a trial, you know, they might just be in a different, you know, level of wanting to address the different issues that are either related to the appeal or not related to the appeal. So, so I would always say prepare your client to, you know, their expectations for mediation. It's not another trial. There's not going to be any new evidence presented as part of the appeal. You know, we're really left with the record that was made in the trial court. I would also have attorneys prepare their themselves and their clients for different emotions that might occur during the mediation. That is something that I have found that there are some attorneys that are really good at handling emotions.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought of that. I wouldn't have thought about preparing my client for that. That's interesting.
Well, it's just, you know, to expect emotions, because I think a lot of times if attorneys see that their client is becoming emotional, they see that as a bad sign. And I always think of that as a really great sign, because it's, you know, that is what is really, you know, whatever they're becoming emotional about is what is really driving the litigation. And if it's something that they can get resolved, then we can kind of move forward from that. Then I kind of know what's important to them to see if we can reach some sort of resolution. So I always try to tell people, you know, expect emotions, and that's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. And I would also, you know, give advice about, you know, the time frame for an appeal is a lot of times very different from the trial court proceedings. It can take up to a year to get an appeal resolved. And that includes, you know, getting the transcript prepared, the briefs written, an argument before our court, and then time for our court to enter a decision. You know, sometimes it takes less time, sometimes it takes more time depending on the complexity of the record or the issues that are on appeal. And also, they need to have a candid conversation with their client about the expenses. You know, if it was a multiple day trial, they might be spending thousands of dollars to prepare a transcript. So those are all things to take into consideration when it comes to, you know, either mediating a case or proceeding on with the appeal.
Is there any negotiations about where and when an appellate mediation can take place?
That can vary. Typically, we try to, and I would say probably all appellate districts try to have a mediation right after the notice of appeal is filed. And that is just to save everybody the time and the expense that might come with preparing transcripts and writing briefs and spending a lot of time researching the various issues on appeal. However,
you're trying to get past all those. Get a mediation can save you all that money and time from all that. Yeah, that makes sense.
Exactly. However, there have been some situations where the attorneys really want to research an issue. Mm-hmm. So they are more clear about, you know, a legal point or like some sort of factual issue that happened that they want to review the transcripts about to make sure that, you know, whatever that issue is was made part of the record. So there are times where they want to wait until the transcript is completed and they have an opportunity to do a little more research. And then there are also times where they get through, you know, the briefing, and they go to oral argument, and then sometimes the case gets referred back to mediation. So I would say that there's the best stage is probably right after the notice of appeal is filed, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the mediation can't take place in other stages. So there's really not a best time. It just really depends on the case and when the parties would like to mediate it.
Now, this is a question for Carrie, but Rick, feel free to chime in as well, since you're the ethics guru here. Are there ethical considerations in preparing your client for mediation?
Well, I think, you know, mediation is just another form of dispute resolution outside of the courtroom, perhaps, and outside of the traditional trial format. So you always want to make sure that your client's been advised of, you know, what mediation is, how that's an alternative to traditional dispute resolution, say within a courtroom in the trial setting. Make them aware of what the procedures are, what's going to occur, prepare them for, you know, what the other side might be doing. It's just a different form of making sure your client is aware of what's going on and can make informed decisions about, you know, how a case might get resolved through mediation. I mean, and I think that's the biggest issue is, you know, is making sure that client is aware of what the possible outcomes are and what your authority is as the lawyer to negotiate on behalf of that client.
Anything you need to add to that one, Carrie?
No, you know, not in terms of ethical obligations, but, you know, the only other thing that I think is really important when preparing for a mediation is to really consider the expectations of the opposing side as well. You know, what is it that they are looking for? Is it something that your client also wants? You know, is there any room to reach an agreement as to some common things? And then, you know, narrow down the scope of the appeal. So I think it's really important to try to figure out exactly what, you know, the expectations of the opposing side are as well, just to see if there can be room for some common ground that's met at the mediation.
And I think that's interesting what you said, to narrow the scope of the appeal. Are there benefits to mediation even if you don't reach a resolution on the actual issue at hand? Are there other ways that appellate mediation can help?
Yeah, and that's what I always, you know, tell attorneys who call and say, you know, we're really concerned. We don't think that we can reach an agreement. And I let them know that even if we can't reach a resolution about all of the issues, you know, maybe we can just limit down the scope of the appeal. Maybe we can reach resolution, you know, let's say on some of the property issues on a divorce or, you know, the spousal support issue. And then maybe the appeal can just proceed on other various parts. So it's, you know, mediation is not just a tool to try to resolve everything, but you can try to narrow down the scope of the appeal, which can really limit the time and expense that the appeal might be pending.
Yeah, when I used to write appeals, there is sometimes like 12 arguments or something. So if you could limit your research and your writing to like one or two arguments, yeah, I can see how that would save a ton of time.
Right.
And just be able to focus and really think about your arguments on that particular topic.
Right.
Kerry, are there specific methods that you use in appellate mediation? I don't know if it's evaluative or transformative. What's your style?
So in our court, we do not use an evaluative method. And as a matter of fact, I'm not able to tell anybody, you know, what I think, you know, how our court will rule on a certain issue. I can't tell them, you know, this is what I think will happen. We really just use a facilitative style, which means I am just there to try to get the parties to engage in discussion, you know, make sure that everybody understands the process of the appeal, make sure they understand, you know, what's the worst case situation, you know, the worst alternative to a mediated resolution, also the best case scenario, just make sure that everybody's informed about all the possibilities that can happen, and, you know, help them make the best decision that they can for their circumstances. And I would say most courts use the facilitative style of mediation, where we are really just trying to get the parties to engage in discussion to see if we can come up with some sort of a resolution.
What types of cases do you think mediation can be most effective for at the appellate level?
You know, that there's really not an easy answer for that, but definitely summary judgment type cases. And I would say any sort of municipal court type case, especially landlord-tenant cases. Foreclosure cases are really well suited for mediation. There are some situations where the case might come down to an interpretation of a law, and sometimes those can be really difficult because the parties really do just want a decision from our court on how we are going to interpret, you know, a new statute or a new law, you know, some sort of new case law that has come out. So, you know, it really just depends. And sometimes, you know, sometimes it works. You know, one time we had a case where the trial court interpreted a statute a way that one of the parties did not want, you know, the trial court to do that. So they wanted a mediation because they did not want our court, you know, to interpret that statute any further. So it really just depends on the situation. So, but I would definitely say, you know, foreclosure type cases and municipal court cases are really well suited for mediation.
So I want to talk about appellate mediation with pro se individuals. And for those listening, when we say pro se, we mean a self-represented litigant. And I actually looked up that Latin because I could not remember what that meant. And it said in one's own behalf or for self. So you're welcome. I Googled that for you all. So is there a different or are there mediation strategies or techniques that you would suggest for when one of the parties or both the parties are pro se litigants?
Well, I think it depends if you're talking to the pro se person or the attorney, you know, who's going to be trying to negotiate with the pro se individual. But, you know, appellate courts in Ohio have handled this different ways. Some appellate courts don't mediate with pro se parties. Some of them mediate, and other ones, you know, encourage the pro se person to have representation if they can at the mediation. And our court has taken that third path. We've paired up with the Toledo Bar Association. And when we notify the pro se, any pro se litigants in our court that the case is being scheduled for mediation, we send them information about the Toledo Bar Association's pro bono program that would allow them to have an attorney present with them for purposes of mediation in our court. So, and that's really because, you know, under that new Rule 16 of the Rules of Superintendents, and also under the Model Standards of Conduct for Mediators, mediators cannot give legal advice to pro se parties. So, you know, sometimes pro se parties have very different ideas about what the law is. And they're not quite familiar, you know, just because they find something on the internet doesn't necessarily mean that it's applicable to their situation. And it might have been applicable, you know, in the trial court, but it's not really applicable anymore in the Court of Appeals. So a lot of times they are really, you know, kind of struggling to understand what the law is and what they should do about it. And we can't tell them, you know, this is what's going to happen in the court. We can't tell them, you know, we can't give them any legal advice. We just have to try to continue working with them. So for the pro se parties, you know, I encourage them to get representation. And for the attorneys on the other side who might be unwilling to mediate with a pro se party, you know, I say, you know, we have this new program where we're, you know, there might be an attorney that comes to mediate with this pro se individual. So I think my advice would be, you know, different for either, you know, whether or not they're represented or not. And I do, you know, ask questions at a mediation. Let's say, you know, if there's somebody with an attorney and somebody who is not represented, I will ask just general questions to the attorney who is in the room, you know, like in your experience, what typically happens in this situation, you know, just to try to get some information out there, you know, to clarify exactly what the laws are and, you know, what might happen in this particular situation. So
there's a lot of hurdles for pro se litigants in these situations and any situations, even the legal terminology can be a huge barrier. I mean, you know, it's like when you go to law school, it's like learning a new language. And yeah, so I can see that a referral to an attorney is probably the most solid, most comfortable for the pro se litigant. But yeah, it's a uphill battle for the pro se litigants for sure. Rick, as for ethics, are there any, I know Carrie had already talked about not giving legal advice. Are there any other ethical considerations for the mediator, for an attorney mediator when there's a pro se litigant involved?
Not particularly. I mean, the judicial rules, the Code of Judicial Conduct has some provisions for judges and magistrates who have cases involving self-represented litigants and allow a judge or judicial officer to make reasonable accommodations to facilitate that individual's presentation of the case to the court. So reasonable accommodations might mean explaining legal terminology, directing them to a form that needs to be completed for the court to fully consider their case, you know, taking account into account the self-represented litigants on familiarity with maybe rules of evidence and the presentation of evidence to make sure that, you know, evidence that that individual, let's say it's exhibits that that individual wants to put in, aren't unduly excluded from evidence. Outside of the courtroom setting, you know, mediators aren't considered judicial officers, although some of them may be magistrates. But they, nonetheless, I think the guidance that's in the Code of Judicial Conduct is helpful to mediators, whether they're attorneys or not, in terms of resolving cases when they have self-represented litigant in front of them. You know, what we try to tell the judges and magistrates is that you're going to see self-represented litigants. So what can you do within the confines of the Code of Judicial Conduct to make the case presentation a little easier for everyone involved so that, you know, you're not frustrated as a judicial officer in dealing with a self-represented litigant because they're not understanding terminology, they're not understanding the order in which evidence is presented, those kinds of things. The idea here is to get to the truth and get to do that in a fair manner. Now, you don't want to compromise the other side who is represented, but you do want to do what you can to accommodate that self-represented litigant. And I think those same considerations come into play when you're talking about mediation.
And I wanted to turn to you about limited scope representation, such as Carrie was talking about the referral service they have to the Toledo Bar Association to give self-represented litigants an attorney for mediation purposes. What is limited scope representation?
Well, limited scope is, it goes by a couple of different names. It's sometimes referred to as limited scope representation. It's sometimes referred to as unbundled legal services. And basically it gives a lawyer and a client the ability to reach an agreement on something less than full scope representation. So in the context of mediation, let's say a lawyer is retained by a client, and the client and lawyer may agree that the lawyer will provide representation only through a mediation. And that if the mediation fails for whatever reason and the case proceeds to trial, the lawyer will not continue to represent that client. So that's one form of limited scope representation. We see it sometimes with regard to document preparation. In other words, the lawyer may assist in preparing a complaint or an answer, or may assist in preparing discovery documents, but they're not going to enter an appearance on the record, you know, if that case proceeds to trial on behalf of that client. This is something that's been recognized in Ohio's rules since 2007, when Ohio adopted the Ohio version of the model rules of professional conduct. It's been in existence in other jurisdictions much longer than that, but it's something that we train quite a bit on. We train quite a bit on for lawyers. We train for judges too, because many judges don't understand that a lawyer doesn't have to be in from beginning to end in a case, that they can provide some limited legal services. And again, mediation is a perfect example of how that can occur. It's, you know, designed for several reasons, one of which is to reduce the cost of litigation to the client, because they may not want to pay an attorney to do everything in a case from beginning to end. They may only want to get some assistance at the early stages of the proceeding and then proceed to represent themselves throughout the remainder of the proceeding.
Do you see it having a facility in appellate mediation?
Oh, I think so. I started my career as a Court of Appeals clerk in Columbus at the 10th District. So some of what Carrie said about, you know, issues that she faces with lawyers who practice in the 6th District haven't changed in the 30 some years since I clerked at the Court of Appeals.
We still haven't gotten them to read the local rules in 30 years.
Local rules, you know, anything and everything, listening to the case assignment manager, you know, preparing their briefs appropriately, those kinds of things. And in any event, I think there's definitely room for, self-represented litigation or self-representation and limited scope representation in appellate mediation. I'm not that familiar with it because we didn't have mediation at that time. We were the first court that hired a referee at that time, or a magistrate, to hear workers' comp cases. So that was the first time somebody had an attorney staff member who wasn't a law clerk or maybe the court administrator. So, but I think it's definitely a good venue for limited scope representation. And again, we have several best practices that we advise lawyers who engage in limited scope representation.
Yeah, hit us with those.
I'm sorry?
Hit us with those.
Okay. This is a good opportunity for me to put a plug in for a document that we put out right around the time of when the appellate conference would have occurred, or the mediation conference would have occurred back in the spring, in March. Right around that time, we were going to unveil it at this conference. The board issued an ethics guide on limited scope representation. And just to tell you what our ethics guides are, they are something that's prepared by the staff. And it's a combination of what are the requirements under the rules of professional conduct, or the code of judicial conduct if it's a judge guide. What advice has the board given in the past in formal advisory opinions? And what are some best practices that lawyers or judges should be following when they're, say, engaged in limited scope representation? So our ethics guide on limited scope representation is available from the board's website. We have five ethics guides now that we've issued over the years, and this is our most recent one. But some of the things that we advise lawyers in that ethics guide is, probably first and foremost, is that limited scope representation doesn't mean limited in quality or competence. So if you're going to provide representation on a limited scope basis, and let's say it's in mediation, that doesn't mean that you go into this unprepared, that you go into it. It's not something you dabble in to maybe develop a competence for other clients by representing someone in a limited scope representation. The rules of professional conduct apply to limited scope representation just as they would in a full scope representation. So limited scope doesn't mean limited competence. You need to make sure, probably second most important consideration, is to make sure that your client is aware of the nature of the limited scope representation. We see many times in our disciplinary cases where a lawyer does not have a written fee agreement with a client, and there's a dispute about what the fee is, how it's going to be calculated, what legal services the lawyer is actually going to be providing to the client. And those things get lawyers in trouble very, very frequently in terms of disciplinary matters. And in a limited scope representation, it's just as important to lay out exactly when your services begin and when they end, so that the client does not have an expectation that, let's say a mediation fails, you are going to write a brief and argue the case before the Sixth District Court of Appeals. So the other thing that our rules require, not only that you communicate that to the client, but the limitation on any representation has to be reasonable under the circumstances. And that's a case-by-case determination about what that means that I won't go into here. But we suggest in the ethics guide that you use checklists for your client, so that the client sees exactly what you're going to do and what he or she is going to be responsible for. And then how those fees are going to be determined for the services that you're going to be providing.
Would you recommend that attorneys start adding unbundled services to their practice? Is there a benefit to the attorneys to do this type of work?
Oh, I think it's a good way to get business in the door. I mean, that's a consideration now when you talk with attorneys whose clientele has dropped off some as a result of COVID or other reasons. Some clients just cannot afford to provide, pay for representation from A to Z, as they would have, say, maybe 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. So this is a good way to get a client, in the door, develop a relationship with that client by providing some limited scope representation. And then when the next legal matter comes up, maybe that client will come back to you and say, I'd like to retain you. You did a nice job in this limited scope representation. I'd like you to retain you in this matter for you know, the full scope of representation. So it's also a good way to develop some expertise. Again, we don't recommend that you dabble in this as a way of building expertise, but sometimes, you know, if you're going to get in, maybe you've never done a mediation before and you feel, you know, this is an area of law with which you're familiar, this might be a good way to get your feet wet on the mediation. You still have that standard of competence that you have to follow in providing that representation, but it's perhaps a good way to expand your practice beyond where it is today.
And how do you think limited scope attorneys who could even specialize in dispute resolution would really help clients achieve their goals in appellate court?
Well, that kind of goes beyond my scope of representation with respect to ethics, but I think I'll pass on that question. Maybe Carrie can answer that a little bit better.
Yeah, what do you think, Carrie? How do you think that limited scope attorneys who know a lot about dispute resolution could help their clients in appellate court?
Well, I think that, you know, whether or not they're knowledgeable about dispute resolution, we have had a lot of attorneys who are extremely knowledgeable about an area of law, and they have been fantastic for being present at the appellate mediation because they can answer questions. A lot of times the pro se parties will, you know, they're not completely indigent. They're definitely competent. You know, they feel comfortable representing themselves on appeal. However, they might not have been able to afford an attorney throughout the process. And they've been kind of, you know, trying to handle all of this on their own. And if we get an attorney that's knowledgeable about, you know, even if it's dispute resolution or about the area of law that they're there, you know, to assist the pro se individual with, you know, they can clarify an issue for them in minutes where it might have taken that pro se individual, you know, hours and hours of time to try to resolve on their own. And then we can quickly reach a resolution. So, you know, so I, and that attorney, you know, can just, can really get some experience in the dispute resolution process, but also, you know, use their knowledge to, you know, in that specific area of law during the mediation. So it's kind of a win-win for everybody. And I'm really glad that the Supreme Court has, you know, created a rule in this new toolkit from the Board of Professional Conduct. So it's been very helpful in mediations in our court.
We're getting near the end of our podcast today. And there's a bit that I like to do at the end of every podcast, and it's called Two for Me and One for You. So I'll have two questions for you, the presenters, and one question that you'll be able to offer the audience kind of as a pop quiz to see if everybody out there has been paying attention today. So first I'll turn to Carrie. Carrie, what's an interesting and relatively brief mediation-related story you can share with us?
Well, one of them, I would say, and this just goes back to, you know, pro se parties. We had an eviction case, but it was from a trailer park. And so I was really not familiar with the entire body of law that dealt with lien holders when it came to, you know, whose property the trailer was. And we really could not get anywhere because this particular litigant found some laws from Arkansas you know, that she really thought were applicable to her case, you know, as to what would happen to, what would happen to the trailer park. So, her home, just because of the value, of moving it versus the value of, keeping it were, probably about equal at that point. So it was really eye-opening to me. And that is kind of the point where I thought, wow, if we just could have an attorney here who could answer this question for her and just give her a little bit of advice. This just seems like something that should be resolved. So I think that just kind of highlights the importance of having attorneys available for anybody who might need it at mediations. So we did not resolve the case that day.
And Rick, do you have any interesting mediation or ethics related stories you can share with us?
Well, we don't see many cases involving mediation that come before the board. There are a number of interesting ethics stories that I could share out there. Unfortunately, they're all cases that are pending. Sort of caught me off guard, Kate. I'm trying to think of something that I can actually talk about.
I love reading the Board of Professional Conduct opinions that come out. You're just like, oh man, what was that attorney thinking?
Yeah. Well, and that is something that sometimes we see these cases. You read the complaint when it comes in, and you get a little bit deeper into the case as it goes through a panel, and you're wondering, what was this attorney thinking? One of the things that we see quite frequently, although fortunately not of late, but we had a run a few years ago of cases where lawyers engaged in sexual relations with clients, which is a no-no under the rules. And you wonder, you know, it's very clear in the rule, you don't do that unless it's a pre-existing relationship. And you wonder what the lawyer was thinking when he or she entered into this relationship with the client, and knowing that it's clearly prohibited by the rules. I think the instances in which lawyers fail to properly communicate with clients is probably one of the biggest issues that we see. And you know, just it's very, very simple to do this, but also at the same time, put boundaries on client communication, because some clients feel that if they have a lawyer's cell phone number, they can send that lawyer a text at any time of day and they expect an immediate answer from that lawyer. And we've even gone so far to advise lawyers to put in their fee agreements that you're only going to return messages, you know, phone calls that are made to the office. Although some lawyers work off their cell phone and only will return calls during regular business hours. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, to try to set that expectation up front with the client. So, you know, those just communication issues and other things that just sometimes cause you to shake your head when you wonder if this lawyer could have just done one thing differently, he or she would not be before the board, but yet they're here. So,
yeah, not the letter you want to receive for sure.
No, that personal and confidential letter that sometimes gets people scared.
Yeah. All right, Carrie, who is an amazing person that is related to mediation or your career, and why do you appreciate them?
I am going to say Dave Doyle at the 10th District Court of Appeals. Rick, I don't know if Dave was there when you worked at the 10th District. Probably not, since they didn't have a mediation program back then. But Dave has been a mentor since I started working for our court as the mediator back in 2012. And I would say he's probably done that with all of the mediators, all of the appellate mediators across the state of Ohio. He has, you know, helped, you know, given us information about, you know, best practices and appellate mediation programs. And he's always open if we have any questions, you know, about specific issues, you know, because it's a very limited pool of people who mediate appellate cases for courts in Ohio. So he has always been very freely giving up his time and has been a mentor for me and probably all of the other appellate mediators across the state. So I would say Dave Doyle of the 10th District. He's been fantastic.
Oh, thanks. All right, Rick, who's a person you would like to shout out, I guess, that who's related to your career or the Board of Professional Conduct, and why do you appreciate them?
Well, I think former Chief Justice Moyer is someone who was clearly a mentor of mine. He was on the Court of Appeals when I clerked there. I did not clerk for him when he was on the 10th District before he came to the Supreme Court. But he was Chief Justice when I was hired at the court in 89 and had been in that role just for a couple of years at that point in time. But he was a role model for so many people and really the father of mediation in Ohio in terms of starting, understanding that dispute resolution, alternative dispute resolution, whether that's mediation or arbitration or whatever it might be, as a viable alternative to resolving disputes in court, you know, in the traditional courtroom setting. And he created, you know, what is now an entire section of the Supreme Court, spawned the various mediation programs around the state, and it was really one of his first and obviously most successful endeavors as Chief Justice to promote mediation throughout Ohio. But then just personally being able to work with him very closely for many years when I was on court staff, set a very high bar for collegiality, ethics, humanity, and humility. So he's definitely right up there on the list of mentors and people that I learned quite a bit from and have the greatest respect for.
What an amazing person to spread access to justice like that through the whole state and have such a wide-ranging impact.
Absolutely.
All right, now it's time to give the audience a knowledge check. Either of you can do this, but what's a pop quiz question that our listeners should be able to answer now after listening to you on this podcast?
Well, I'll throw one out since I punted over to Carrie earlier. before she gets back at me, I would ask the listeners to think about what's the most important thing if you're entering in, you as a lawyer, if you're entering into a limited scope representation, whether it's in mediation or any other field, what's the most important consideration for you in communicating with your client?
Thank you. I'll leave our audience to think about that one. And Carrie, any closing statements before we sign off today?
No, I thank you very much, Kate, for putting this podcast together. And thank you, Rick, for talking about the ethical implications of limited scope representation. That's really all I have. Hopefully everybody takes advantage of appellate mediations across the state of Ohio. And we'll look forward to seeing you at mediation.
Thank you. And Rick, anything else?
No, great working with you, Kate, and for the first time, and Carrie, to work with you again. And hopefully this was helpful to everyone, and look forward to maybe doing it in person next year.
Right. Well, thank you to Carrie Connolly and Rick Dove, our presenters today. And thank you to our audience and for everyone who is working towards justice in Ohio. Thank you.